Good, good. Now we gotta get organized here. Don't be fooled by all these pages because I usually forget them and do my own thing anyway. Well, isn't it nice to see you all? I sometimes think that all the Christian Scientists in the world must live in California. Because there's always a good turnout here. I would like, first of all, to thank the First Church of Christ Scientist in Long Beach for bringing me here, for their very generous offer to bring me here to pay my fare so that other churches are enabled to be benefited by the talk at the same time. I think it was very generous of them, and I thank them very much. And I would also like to thank our organist today. Wasn't that lovely music? I was enjoying it so much that I could have stayed back there and not bothered to come out here. Well, I think that a lot of you people know me already through my tapes, and I just feel that I know you as well because, you know, I just feel the warmth and the love that comes back from you, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Well, this is a new talk, so it's quite new to me as well as to you. But it's not really new to me because it's something that I have been cherishing in my thought for several years. Living in a country like Northern Ireland and seeing all this war going on and all the terrible things that were happening in my own life made you feel sometimes that nothing good was going on or was ever going to happen. But I began to see like a golden thread right through my life that God's law of restoration was always present and in operation, right where the gloom and the doom and the hopelessness and the depression appear to be. And so it's been growing and developing in my thought, and this is just the outcome of it. Now, restore means putting back into nearly or quite the original form. Have you ever restored a piece of furniture or done up an old house? Have you? Well, you know that that's a very satisfying thing to do, but it's also a lot of hard work. The first thing you have to do, if you're going to restore a piece of furniture, for instance, is to recognize that there's something of value there. You have to recognize that there is some beauty, some goodness, something worthwhile that makes it worthwhile to restore it. That is called redemption. When you do that, you redeem the article from destruction, or you redeem a house from destruction, or a garden. Anything that you want to redeem and restore, you have to redeem it first. And if you've ever done that, you know that the first thing you have to do is clean it all down. And that's usually the hardest bit of all, because sometimes it can take weeks or months of consistent cleaning a piece of furniture to get it right down before you can start to restore it. Well, that's what we have to do for mankind as well, for ourselves and for our loved ones and for our enemies as well. And we also have to hold in mind what the finished object will look like. We have to have hope and faith and a picture in our thought that will tell us what this thing's going to be like at the end of the day. That's what keeps us going. And that's what we have to do when we're restoring our concept of man. We have to see man as God sees him. And that makes it all worthwhile. That helps us when we have to clean off layers of dirt that we see in other people or sometimes in ourselves. I have a young friend who's a Christian Science nurse. And I noticed the lovely qualities that he put into his nursing. And his whole life was dedicated to the cause of Christian Science. I was very impressed by this young man, and one day when I was in his company, I told him that I admired what he was doing and his total dedication to his work. And he replied that he hadn't always been that way. And he told me that his mother was left a widow with three young children to bring up. She was a very strong Christian Scientist. She brought them all up in the Sunday school and read them the lesson every day and made them apply it in their lives. But when he became a teenager, he began to rebel. And he thought he was missing something, that all his friends didn't have these restrictions. So he wanted to go out, and like the prodigal son, he went out and spent his money on riotous living. He got into drinking and drugs and promiscuous living and grew away from his family. He didn't want to go home. He didn't want anybody to preach to him. Well, one day, while he was under the influence of drugs, he crashed his car. It was a new car that his mother had bought him for his birthday. And he crashed the car. The car was a total write-off. And he was taken into a hospital. The hospital, of course, asked who his next of kin was, and his mother had to be informed. So his mother came to the hospital, and he was in pretty bad shape. And he was angry. He didn't want the hospital to tell his mother, and he didn't want her there, and he didn't want her preaching at him. And he had decided, well, he was going for medical care, and that's the way he was going to work it out. But he said that when his mother came to visit him, she never reproached him. She never said, when are you going to stop all this? She never said anything about the condition he was in. And she came for 3 days. She had to come a long way to visit him. She came for 3 days to visit him. And on the third day, she was going home that evening. She opened her purse and she took out a set of car keys and she said, there's the keys of your car. And he said, well, what good are keys? I have no car. And she said, well, I bought you a new car, exactly the same as the car you had before. And he said, Mother, why did you do that? After all the things that I've been doing to you and the way I've been living. She said, I'm not impressed by that. She said, do you remember when you were a little boy and you came in one day, you were playing soccer and someone hit you with a ball and your face was covered in blood? She said, do you remember that I turned my back on you and I said, right, get your clothes off and put into the washer. And you kept saying, oh, Mom, look at my face. I'm all covered in blood. And she kept turning her back and she said, no, I'm not going to look. Get your clothes off, put them in the washer, and go in the shower. And she refused to look. So finally, he had to get off his clothes. He put them in the washer and he had a shower. And when he came out, there wasn't a scratch on him. He couldn't see anything wrong with him at all. Well, she said, this means no more to me than the blood I saw on your face. She said, your real selfhood is untouched, and I refuse to be hypnotized by it or react to it. He said when his mother went out of the room, he began to cry like he hadn't cried in years. And he said that the way his mother handled the situation did more for him than if she had been angry and told him off. He said that day he promised he would dedicate the rest of his life to the cause of Christian Science. He came back into Christian Science and he's still in it and he's still nursing. What a woman she was. Didn't she express the real motherhood of God? She didn't come down and cry and lament like a lot of us do all the time. She refused to react. Now, that was God's law of redemption. She redeemed him from being willful and sinful and extravagant and all the things that she could have attached to him. She redeemed him from that and she restored him to his true sonship, his oneship with God. Oh, the power of God's law of restoration, which is going on everywhere right now. Everywhere we see gloom, disease, depression, decay, death, problems, right there is God's law of restoration. And if we would stop trying to pray so much about our problem, drop the problem, and say to ourselves, I am going to recognize God's law of redemption and restoration right now in my life and in my experience and in my body and in my thinking and in my finances, my family, my life, my home, my church. That would do a lot for all of us and for our world. Because while we dwell on the problem and talk about it, we're making a reality of it. Sometimes we just can't seem to resist talking about our problem. We want to tell all our family. We want to tell everybody we meet. We're only impressing it upon them and giving ourselves more work to do. So instead of doing that, claim God's law of restoration. Mrs. Eddy defines resurrection as spiritualization of thought, a new and higher idea of immortality or spiritual existence, material belief yielding to spiritual understanding. Now we will know that we're rising into resurrection when we feel this spiritualization of thought, a new and higher idea of immortality. When we feel that, we'll know we're on the way to healing, because that's resurrection in our thinking, and we need that resurrection. We need to get out of crucifixion and into resurrection. I'd like to give you an illustration of how God's law of restoration works. I want to tell you how it worked in this family. Because you and I need to learn not to accept every false picture that's presented to us, no matter how aggressive it is. A couple of years ago, I had a call from a woman. I was at home and she was in America. And she told me that she thought she had a heart problem. She had great difficulty breathing and even walking. And she was just tired and exhausted all the time. And she had a lot of pain. So I began to help her. I began to pray for this resurrection thought, to redeem her from being this mortal with this problem, and to resurrect her true identity and selfhood. Well, she began to feel a little bit better, but after a couple of weeks, she rang up and she said she had another problem that she hadn't told me about. And this problem was, she was extremely upset by the problems in the Christian Science movement, which were spilling over into her little branch church. And there seemed to be two camps in her church, seemed to be very divided. All this was upsetting her and making her ill. And there was one member of her church that she hadn't spoken to for 3 years. And she felt she couldn't speak to this person, and she felt she shouldn't. So I began to talk to her about forgiveness. I pointed out to her that our Master could never have been resurrected, and he could never have ascended if he didn't forgive. I said, even on the cross, he forgave those that crucified him, those that put nails into his hands and his feet and a sword in his side and a crown of thorns upon his head. But the last thing he said was, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And I said, while you hold a false picture of someone, you're keeping healing from yourself. Because Jesus needed to forgive everyone, even Judas, before he could be resurrected. And that she needed to do that too. And I pointed out that the Master said in the Sermon on the Mount that we have to do this, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. So we have to do it. We have to forgive. So she began to see this, and we talked a lot about forgiveness, and we began to talk about this woman that she couldn't speak to and the other members of her church and Christian Scientists everywhere throughout the world. We began to see that each and every one of them, no matter what we thought of them humanly, is the beloved child of God, is without sin, without knowledge of evil, because that's how God sees them. Well, after we prayed this way for another couple of weeks, she rang me up and she said, what do you think? I went to church on Wednesday night. I was able to go to this woman and hug her. And she said the whole church noticed and were pleased and thrilled. And she was appointed first reader of her church. And she was making progress. But it didn't seem to be fast enough. And you know, when God's law of redemption and resurrection is put into action, it uncovers every piece of error. So, a couple of weeks after that, she came back again. She said, there's something else I need to tell you, Myrtle, she said. I haven't been able to tell anybody this. So she began to tell me that she had problems in her marriage. That her husband, for many years, had been involving her in sexual activities that she knew were not right. Now, her husband was the man who brought her into Christian Science. She was appointed first reader, and she thought that it wasn't right for her to have all this on her mind, and it certainly wasn't. So we began to pray for her husband as well, to know that he, too, was the pure, the whole, the satisfied, the sinless child of God, that he was without knowledge of evil, and that these habits were nothing but world thought being portrayed onto his consciousness, onto the screen of his thinking, and he just didn't know how to handle it. And after we prayed this way for quite a while, it took quite a while, there was wonderful healing in that family. She didn't want to leave her husband. He was a good man, a good provider, a good father, and he was the person who had brought her into Christian Science. And he was so relieved that it was all out in the open, and to know that Christian Science could heal even that problem, that he prayed with us. And it was a lovely time of this whole family sharing this precious time together. Now, God's love did not condemn. It redeemed and it restored. It restored love and harmony, unity and respect in that family and in that church. And to this woman, she had healing in her body as well as in her life. So that's just one incident in which God's law of restoration goes to work. Mrs. Eddy said that sensualism is not bliss, it is bondage. And if we want to overcome the pains of the flesh, we must also overcome the pleasures. You see so much on television now about promiscuous living, about lesbians and gays and couples, and it seems if you're not living like that, you're not in the fashion, that there's something wrong with you. It can become so hypnotic. But you know, it doesn't matter whether it's two men or two women or a man or a woman. The real problem is that these people are being dictated to by their body, by a body that says, I have all these needs and I have to satisfy them. And they don't know the harm that they're doing to themselves by giving in to that. Because if they had to overcome the pain of a disease that might have come out of these experiences that they're having, they would find it much more difficult to do that. But I think our young people today in this age are being tempted like no age ever before. It's so difficult for them to take a stand that I really feel that we need to be praying for them. We need to be sitting in our home summits, embracing the young people of the world, and knowing that their purity and innocence cannot be lost nor taken from them, that they reflect the one infinite mind, and they have the intelligence, the wisdom, and the willingness to do the right thing. Talking about drugs, this young man on drugs, I had an experience with my son some years ago. He had left home and he was living in an apartment with a couple of his friends. And I don't know, he was about 22 or 23 at the time. And one night, late on a Saturday night, I had a phone call from a man who said, I am Dr. So-and-so. Can I speak to Paul? And I said, well, he doesn't live here. I could give you his number. He said, well, I must get in touch with him immediately. He said, he's due in at the hospital tomorrow. Now, my son had never been to a doctor in his life. So I said to this doctor, I think you've got the wrong phone number. No, he said, it's Paul Smith. And I said, yes. He said, did you not know that your son is crippled with arthritis? He said, it's in his knees, it's in his hands. And he said, there's not much that we're going to be able to do about it. He said, he's probably going to be in a wheelchair in about 3 months, and he'd be in that for the rest of his life. I just couldn't believe that I was hearing all this. Anyhow, I got in touch with my son, and I asked him, was it right? And he said, yes, it is right, Mother, and I don't want you to interfere. He said, I do not want Christian Science treatment. I said, well, Paul, you've never had a doctor in your life. He said, I'm now an adult, and I make my own decisions, and I've decided I'm going into a hospital, and I'm going to have this treatment. So I said, well, I'll come up to the hospital the next day to see you. And I came up, and Paul was there, and he looked ill, and he looked like he was in a lot of pain. And he said, Mother, don't interfere. Please don't come to the hospital to see me. I don't want you to come and see me. I want to have medical treatment. And this young doctor came out to see me and asked me if I would come into his office. And he said, your son has told me that you're a Christian Science practitioner, and that he doesn't want Christian Science treatment. He said, Christian Science couldn't help this. This disease is incurable, and your son is going to be a cripple. And he said, really, he's an adult, and it's none of your business. And I replied, how dare you tell me it's none of my business? It's my business more than anybody else's business in this world. And you can't stop me from praying. So I went home, and I was very angry, and I had to get over that and simmer down. I knew that that wouldn't heal anything and it wouldn't help anything. So I began to pray. I knew that he didn't want treatment, but I had to treat myself so that I couldn't be hypnotized by this picture. Well, every day I went up, they had him drugged more heavily and given him all different treatments and so forth. And sometimes they wouldn't let me in to see him. But one day it was our annual holiday time, and this doctor called me and said, would you mind taking Paul home for 3 days, because we're going to be short-staffed, and would you just take him home? We'll send him in an ambulance. And I thought, great, this is my chance. I was delighted. But Paul came home so heavily drugged, he didn't come out of it for 3 days. He didn't even eat or drink or anything. He was unconscious. And I was so distressed, I was ready to pull my hair out, and I felt so helpless. And then the scientific statement of being came to me. And I said to myself, there is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in these drugs. Why am I giving them power? They have no power to heal them, but they have no power to harm him. And I'm not going to give them power. I suddenly realized, well, even as Christian scientists, we give tobacco power and drink power. We say if somebody would give up the smoking and give up the drinking. But what if someone came to you who had smoked for 50 years and the doctor said their lungs were destroyed? Would you say, well, you shouldn't have smoked and I can't help you? You wouldn't say that. You have to know that no part of man has ever been hurt or injured or damaged. And so that's what I began to see and to know for him, that there was no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in these drugs. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth. Matter is mortal error. Drugs are mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material. He is spiritual. Well, that night I went to bed and slept content. The next morning, Paul woke up and said he was starving, and I brought him in his breakfast, and he said, "You were at your work last night, weren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I was." I said, "Paul, I had to do it for me. You couldn't stop me from doing that." Do you know that 2 weeks after that, he rode a bicycle marathon from Belfast to Dublin, 200 miles there and back. He never came into Christian Science. He comes to it when he has a problem, but it didn't matter to me. I learned a lesson which helped me to help other people under medical care or on drugs or whatever. We must not believe that drugs could interfere with the life or the joy or the peace or the harmony of God's man. You know, I remember when I wanted to be a Christian Science practitioner. I was going through terrible things in my marriage. My husband was physically abusing me. He was with women. He drinking. He was keeping money from me. And there were terrible things happening in our province. And I had been able to get 4 of my children into a Christian Science school in England. And this, to me, was absolutely wonderful because they were lifted out of the situation in the country and in my home. But finances were really low in our home. My husband didn't give me much money and kept everything from me. So I had to figure out how to get these kids home from school and how to buy their uniforms and everything else. And it was very difficult. And I felt that I needed to take a job. And I got a job in a china shop in town. And after a couple of weeks there, the boss began to praise me and tell me that I was a very good saleswoman, that the customers liked me, and I got on with them very well. And he kept saying to me that one day I had a particularly good sale, and he said, "You know, you keep on like this and you'll be getting good promotion in a month or so." And at first I was very pleased, but then that night I went home and I listened to the news about all these bombs that had happened, and look at more funerals and sad faces. And I thought, what am I doing in a china shop? Anybody could sell china, but anybody couldn't heal. And I thought, this country needs me, even if I never have a patient. I need to be at home. I need to keep my thought above this. I need to pray for my country. Now, you've all heard me tell in all my talks many things about my husband, but I want to tell you one nice thing about him that he did for me. He did a few nice things. And that was on the day that I come home from a china shop and I told him that I had told the boss I wasn't going back. And he looked absolutely astounded and said, well, how are you going to manage? How are you going to bring the kids home? I can't give you any money and so forth. And he was walking past a mirror and I caught sight of his face and I thought he looked really burdened. And I said to myself, have I a right to put this burden onto him when he doesn't understand what it's all about? So the next day I got up. My boss had said if I changed my mind, the job was there. And the next day I got up and got dressed. And my husband said, where are you going? And we'd received our final telephone bill, which said it was going to be cut off that day, and we didn't have the money to pay it. And he said, where are you going? Why are you all dressed up? And I said, well, I'm going back to work. I think that maybe I'll just have to practice part-time. I think I need to help out in the house. And his face lit up. He looked very pleased. And I went out to get the bus, which was just across the road. And while I was waiting for the bus, he came out and he called me in. And he said, don't go to the china shop. He said, you do have something to give. I know that. And we managed somehow. Well, you know, they were the nicest words that he ever said to me. And I can't tell you how grateful I was for that. The very next day, I had a letter from someone who heard that my children were at school in England, and she sent me a check to help me. And the check was the exact amount of the telephone bill. It was able to get paid. And I made my demonstration just day by day and step by step. It was never all at once. And, you know, at first, I didn't have many patients either. And, you know, we're always telling you in our talks about our success stories. But we have some failures as well. And after I had decided to go into the practice full time, a young couple came to visit me. And they had a little girl aged about 4. And they just had another little baby boy. They were not Christian Scientists. A friend had told them about me. And this little baby was born with water on the brain, and it had a big, big head. And the parents asked me if Christian Science could help. And so I began to pray for this little baby. And the baby began to respond and recover, and I was very pleased. And then one night someone asked me to go out to the theater. And I decided that I'd been in for weeks doing my practice and I hadn't got out any place, decided I would like a night out. When I came back home from the theater, the young mother called, the baby had died. Well, I condemned myself, I blamed myself, I cried, I thought I didn't deserve to be in the practice of Christian Science, and who did I think I was and that I should give it up? And I was so distraught. And the next morning, this young couple came to see me and they brought me a present. And their faces were absolutely radiant. And they said, we want to thank you because we don't feel like we lost our child. We don't feel any sense of death. We can't believe it. And so they thought that that was their healing, and it didn't satisfy me. And I went on working about it and praying about it. Now, this young woman was told she could never have another child. But some months after that, she called me and she said, look, this doctor said I can't have another child. She said, would you pray with me because we want to have another child? So I asked her to come and see me, and told her about Hannah in the Bible, how she prayed for a child, and how her prayer was answered. And I talked to her about Christian Science and that God was the only creator, the only father, and the only mother. And we worked together for a couple of months, and then she conceived. And you know that she had twin boys, big, bouncing babies. And she said she felt she got her first one back and another one as well. And she called one of the boys the name that the other little boy was called. So that was a great lesson to me. You know, I had given up because it didn't work out the way I thought it should. But you see, God's law of redemption and restoration was at work in spite of me. And it's working in spite of you, too. There was one Bible verse that helped me through all those years, and it's still my favorite. It is, "I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten. And my heavenly Father has kept his promise in my case." I could write a book about the ways that my heavenly Father has restored those years to me. And one of them was in the way that he restored my home. When my husband and I sold our family home, and we were each given a half of what was left after we paid our mortgage, and I took out a mortgage on another house, which you heard me talking about in my other previous lectures. And to help me pay the mortgage and the bills, I took in guests. I did bed and breakfast. It was a woman who had a bed and breakfast across the road from me, came to me one day and asked me if I would take a man in for 2 months. And I brought her in. My husband had taken all my furniture and sold it. I didn't have any carpets. I had only one bedroom furnished, and that was mine. There was no carpets in the stairs, and there was only an old broken down settee. And I brought the woman in and I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I would love to be able to take in a few guests that would help me, but you see, my house, it wouldn't be ready for that." "Oh," she said, "this man's an engineer. He's from Scotland. I don't think he's worried about carpets and everything." She said, "As long as the food's good." And she said, "I know you're clean, because every time I look at you, you're cleaning or doing your garden." So she brought this man over, and he said, "I'm not worried about carpets. Don't worry about it." But I had to give him my bedroom, and I slept on the broken down settee. And then when he paid me for a month's pay, I went to the auction and I bought some pieces of furniture and an old carpet, and I painted the room, and I said, "Now I'll put him in there tonight and I'll get into my own bed." And he came home from work with another man. And this went on until I had four guests staying in the house. And they had evening meal and breakfast. And, you know, they were like big sons to me. They would fix the radiators and do things. And soon I had the whole house furnished. And then after a while, the house next door, there were two semi-detached houses. The house next door went up for sale. And my lodger said, "Why don't you buy the house next door?" And I said, "I can hardly pay for this one." But I decided to rent it. I asked the woman if she'd rent it to me for a year to see if it was feasible. And I did that. And soon I was able to put the guests in that side of the house, and my side was for me and my families. And I really physically worked very hard, as well as doing my practice. And I told Boston I was doing this in case it was something wrong. But it seemed to be all right. So I worked really hard at that house. And then I went away lecturing, and then my husband and I got divorced. And by this time, he had a very bad mental problem. And after the divorce, we had to go and see the judge about settling our finances. And the judge said, "This man has a very bad mental problem. He's going to have to be institutionalized soon for the rest of his life." He had a letter from the doctor. "This woman is a Christian Science practitioner and lecturer, and she has a bed and breakfast. So she, this judge, awarded my husband like $50,000, which I didn't have, and I was told to pay it in 3 months. And I was just finishing my last year of lecturing. And a few close friends who knew about this, not many people knew about it, they thought it was so unjust. A couple of them wept, and they said, "This just isn't fair." I said, "I'll have to sell my house." And they said, "It's so unjust. You worked for this house." And by the way, my husband had a lot of money, which he never put in a bank. He put money in shoe boxes. He wouldn't put money in a bank in case anybody knew he had money. But I had no way of proving it because it wasn't in a bank. And so I had to put the house for sale. And because of the situation in Northern Ireland and where the house was, it wouldn't sell. And soon I was having to pay interest on this money, which I didn't have to pay. And so my son came over from London, and he said that he would try and get a mortgage, and he could only get a very small mortgage, but it was enough to allow me to pay my husband this money and pay off the bank. And I was left penniless and homeless at the end of my lecture tour. But you know, I had learned so much from all my experiences that I couldn't be bitter. I couldn't be resentful. And I knew that the God that had taken care of me all those years was still taking care of me. And so I rented a little house about 12 miles from Belfast. I moved in there. I was only in there a month. It was a builder who owned it, and he said that he hadn't been able to sell it. As soon as I got in there and fixed up the house and the garden, everybody wanted to buy it. And so he said, "Well, either you have to buy it or get out." And I mean, I have moved house so many times that my friends say they need an address book just for me. And I thought, oh my goodness, have I to move again? By this time, I was feeling a bit weary. I felt I wanted to put down roots and to belong someplace. Well, a friend of mine and her husband offered to lend me the money to buy this little house. And so I lived there for 2 years, but it didn't feel right to me to be living there on borrowed money. And at the end of 2 years, I felt that really they needed their money, and I had to put this house on the market. And so I did this, and my friends were saying, "Well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go?" And I said, "My Heavenly Father knows all about it. He has promised me he'll restore to me the years that the lotus has eaten, and I believe it." Well, I had been helping a woman in another country, and she died rather suddenly. And I didn't know that she was a wealthy woman. And after she died, her husband rang me up and said he wanted to come and visit me, and said that she had left a request that I be helped in my home situation. And he said, "So I am going to buy a house that you can live in for the rest of your life. You won't have to pay rent. You have it for as long as you want it." It was still his house, but I was allowed to live in it. So he and I both went out house hunting, and we saw one house which was very nice, and it was beside a lock, and it had a beautiful view. And we were going ahead with that house, and on the day that I was to go and sign for it, it suddenly came to me that it wasn't right, that it was too far away from people, it was too far away from airports, and I was doing it just because I wanted somewhere beautiful, and that motive wasn't right. So I went and told the people, "No, I'm not taking that house." And this man was coming over that day to see me and to sign for the house. He was amazed that I didn't take it, and on the same day, my son, who was living in my old home, called me up and said that he and his wife were going to live in Canada, and he was going to sell the house. So my friend immediately said, "Oh, I would love to see where you live. Can we go and see your house?" And all the way there, I kept saying to him, "I'm not going back to this house, you know. I'm definitely, I'm not going back to this house. needs too much doing to it.